Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Africa on the Move and introduce yourself to our listening audience.
Thank you, Lee. It's very nice to be here. My name is Ike Nahum. I'm a Amtrak locomotive engineer. I'm a member of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, and I drive high-speed trains for Amtrak between Washington and New York. And also, I'm affiliated with the Teamsters Union. My main political, I'm a longtime activist in various struggles going back to the fight, the civil rights and black liberation movements of the 60s, which inspired me initially through my introduction as a young teenager, like so many millions of others, to the speeches and writings of Malcolm X. And the movement against the Vietnam War. I'm a longtime trade union activist and socialist activist, but currently my main political activity centers around defense of the Cuban Revolution and to end the remaining economic and travel sanctions that the U.S. government, although it has retreated somewhat in releasing the Cuban Five revolutionaries that were political prisoners held for over a decade in U.S. jails, and also the establishment of diplomatic relations, but there's still a lot of sanctions and U.S. subversion against Cuba, and I'm fighting to end that as part of the national, international Cuba solidarity movement.
Okay, we are thankful for you. Before we get started real quickly, we normally do a little brief update on current events and upcoming activities. Right now, we would like to introduce one of our panelists for the day, Brother Haki, and we're going to ask him briefly give us a little backdrop, updrop on what's going on with African Awareness Association as it relates to their freedom ride to Cuba. Can you just talk a little bit about the upcoming tour to Cuba, Brother Haki?
Sure. In December, we'll be taking a tour to Cuba in defense of the Cubans' right to exist and also support the Cuban people in terms of acknowledging the many wonderful things they have done for the African community and humanity generally. This is a trip that's going to last for approximately 14 days, 12 of which is going to be in Havana and 2 of which is in Matanzas. Now, while we're there in Havana, we'll be participating in the International Jazz Festival, also the Cuban's Independence Day. So we encourage people to come on out, to go to Cuba, to make that ride, and to meet the Cubans firsthand, to engage in discourse in terms of differences, at least perceived differences, that people may have. One of the best ways to find out the truth is actually engage people in discourse. So we encourage people to come on out and to go to Cuba. Now, for more information in terms of particular trip, you can email us at African_Awareness_Association@yahoo.com. That's African_Awareness_Association@yahoo.com. Or they can call us at area code 804-549-7492 or area code 202-714-9435. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. And Brother Anthony, quickly, in terms of upcoming events, activities, are there any things you would like to speak about the nature of the APIPGC, any activities coming up that the public needs to be aware of?
Yes. My name is Anthony Williams. I'm an organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC. Our objective is Pan-Africanism, the total liberation and unification of Africa under scientific socialism. We have African Liberation Day 2016 coming up on May 21st, 2016, and keep that date on your calendar open. There'll be more information forthcoming. Check out our website on a regular basis at www.a-aprp.com. -gc.org.
Okay, thank you, Anthony. So those are our upcoming events. Please stay informed. And as we find more about these activities, we'll share more with you. Yeah, we can get started for this program tonight. And if you address the dean, telling the truth, what's going on in your world? I mean, I'd like to start with Chuck Coughlin with the Alliance for Global Justice. Chuck, can you just briefly, again, talk a little bit in general, what is the Alliance for Global Justice? And once you have done that, maybe share with us some of the upcoming work that the organization is currently taking hold to and what's going on in terms of the activities that they involve themselves in at the present time.
Okay, sure. Well, our Latin America solidarity work is our core work. We focus on four countries, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Colombia, and Honduras. So two countries where they're moving towards socialism, and two countries that are under the thumb of U.S. imperialism. I take delegations to Honduras about twice a year to do human rights accompaniment since the coup in 2009. That was supported by Hillary Clinton's State Department and President Obama. The human rights situation in Honduras has become dire. We moved our headquarters from Washington, D.C. to Tucson, Arizona, which is where many migrants cross the border into the U.S. And in the last few years, the next to Mexicans, Hondurans are the second highest number of people who come across the border fleeing violence and repression in Honduras. Nicaragua, our organization actually started as the Nicaragua Network in 1979 in support of the armed struggle against the Somoza dictatorship that was imposed by the United States, and we've been in solidarity with the Sandinista Revolution in Nicaragua since then. I joined the organization 28 years ago. Today, Nicaragua, there's no war anymore. The Sandinistas were returned to power by election in 2006, and Nicaragua today is a good example of what could have happened had Ronald Reagan not imposed the Contra War on Nicaragua. Nicaragua's one of the countries that is most advanced in fulfilling the UN Millennium Goals of cutting poverty in half by 2020, thanks to Cuba's help, has wiped out illiteracy. Cuba has also helped with the healthcare system there, so everyone has access to healthcare now. A good deal of my focus right now is on Venezuela. Since Hugo Chavez was elected in 1998, the United States has had the goal of regime change in Venezuela, and including the failed coup in 2002, where the people rose up and demanded that Chavez be returned, and he was after 2 days. Unfortunately, he died, and shortly before the election, presidential election in 2013, and the current president, Nicolas Maduro, who was one of the top people in the Chavez government, was elected president in a pretty close election. A very close election. And so the U.S. has really turned up the screws, and as well as the Venezuela oligarchy, to try to make the country ungovernable and to return to return Venezuela to the U.S. orbit under U.S. hegemony and for the oil money instead of going to the needs of the people to go into the pockets of the few. The legislative elections are coming up December 6th, so we're going to be seeing a lot of increased propaganda about Venezuela, you know, accusing it of being an autocracy, and if the opposition loses the elections on December 6th, we're going to hear a lot about how the elections were rigged and whatever, and if they win, then there'll be a whole other line of propaganda to try to reduce Maduro's ability to govern as president. So people should be, you know, should be following that, and they should realize that the most of what they're going to hear in the corporate press and from the mouths of U.S. government are lies. Jimmy Carter has said that Venezuela has the best electoral system in the world. It's almost impossible to cheat. The voting machines, you take a thumbprint so people can't double vote. They get a receipt, a paper receipt that shows their vote so they can double check and make sure the machine accurately recorded it. They put that receipt, after they look it over, into a box. 54% of the boxes are hand counted after the election, comparing them with the machine count, so there's virtually no way that cheating can take place, which certainly isn't true in our own country. Cuba and Venezuela are very important partners in the effort to realize Simón Bolívar's dream of an integrated Latin America that is able to stand against what he called the Colossus of the North, which is the United States. And therefore, you know, the United States, even though the United States is normalizing relations with Cuba, the goal is still regime change in Cuba, and the dream of the imperialists is to return Cuba to its to a neo-colonial state, which I can certainly speak to more authoritatively than I can. So, you know, it may seem like both these countries aren't that important to us here in the United States, but basically, I think everything good in the world that is good in the world is coming out of Latin America, and in many ways, our own liberation is dependent on the success of Venezuela and Cuba. So, I'll leave it at that, but let Ike pick up from there.
Hey Chuck, can you talk a little bit about how the West has misrepresented the realities of what's going on in Venezuela, and how can people engage in this process where they can find out, you know, the real reality of the life, of the lives that have been affected by U.S. policy as relates to Venezuela?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, we've heard, you know, first, the U.S. tried to make it seem like Chavez was, you know, a crazy person, an irrelevant person, you know, the same kind of thing that they did with Gaddafi, where they try to make the leader seem like a buffoon, and so people won't take them seriously. And both men were very serious men. You know, in spite of Venezuela probably has more elections than any place else in the world. I mean, it seems like every time you turn around, Venezuela has a new election. And during the period when Chavez was in power, I believe there were 14 times that people went to the polls, and 13 of those elections were won by healthy majorities by Chavez and his party. The only one that lost was a package of constitutional amendments where they tried to, I think, put too many constitutional amendments all in the same package, and people said, well, wait a minute. And so the Chavistas respected that vote and Democratic vote and reflected on it and made changes. It's entirely possible because things are really difficult for people in Venezuela today. Oil prices have dropped to half of what they were a few years ago, and Venezuela is a country whose economy is very dependent on oil, but also because the artificial shortages have been created by the big companies. So, when people can't find toilet paper or they can't find beans or rice, or the other staples of ordinary working people, they get upset about it. So it's entirely possible that the Chavista Party, the PSUV, Venezuela Socialist, I forget exactly what the acronym stands for, could lose its majority in the National Assembly, which is their Congress, then the Chavista movement is going to need to make some adjustments based on that and move forward. I don't think that the people of Venezuela, I'm sure that the people of Venezuela are not going to throw away the gains that they've achieved under Chavismo, with conquering illiteracy, health care for everyone, education for everyone, better distribution of the oil revenues so that there aren't the desperately poor people that there once were. People have access to enough to eat and et cetera, and they're not going to throw that away. But we'll hear lots of, sky is falling propaganda and claims of human rights violations and lack of democracy, et cetera. The U.S. doesn't care at all about democracy. The U.S. cares about projecting its power, both economic and military, over the rest of the world.
Okay. Chuck, we're going to say hold on. We're going to now go to Ike. Ike, welcome again. Ike, we know that you have been ahead. One of the things we would like to get a perspective from you is, could you tell us in terms of this question, what's going on in your world? One of the issues we would like to get your perspective on this Cuba dynamic and U.S. relations. So we'll start from there, and we'll let you share with our listening audience some issues and topics you think that have a great concern to our communities.
Thank you. I think I forgot to mention in my introductory remarks, I work and I'm an organizer and founder of the July 26 Coalition in New York City, which is a coalition of dozens of groups that put aside whatever other differences they might or might not have politically to unite around solidarity with revolutionary Cuba and to end all remaining U.S. sanctions, and also to, we worked very hard for the freedom of the Cuban Five, which was a very important victory. Just to step back for 1 second and look at what Cuba represents, I think Hakeem, or one of the other panelists, mentioned the role of African liberation, and it's really incredible when you think about it. Cuba's only a country of like 11.2 million people, yet it has been at the center because it was, as Fidel said, a big revolution in a small country. It was at the center of some of the greatest events and most momentous events of the 20th century and continuing to this day. The role of Cuba in African liberation is like legendary, although it may not be that well known in the United States, but it's getting more known. It's certainly known fairly broadly, I think, among African Americans. Nelson Mandela, and it's known in Africa, definitely from top to bottom, in terms of, as Nelson Mandela said, that Cuba's role was decisive in the smashing of apartheid. Cuban troops were sent on rickety boats that they could gather, leaving themselves with almost no navy in 1976 when the racist South African regime was at the gates of Luanda in Angola, which had just won its independence, basically had no army, and South Africa invaded, and Cuba dispatched troops there and smashed them and held them back, and for many years, while South Africa and its agents and lackeys backed by the United States completely, if covertly, eventually fought and defeated the South African army, which led to the unraveling of apartheid and the freeing of Nelson Mandela, other political prisoners, and sort of the collapse of the apartheid state, the winning of independence for Namibia, and so on. And even to this day, I mean, Cuba has sent, Chuck mentioned, talked about a little bit of the Cuban-Venezuela solidarity. I mean, Cuba has not only in Nicaragua, you know, the healthcare. Cuba has more doctors serving around, including in some of the most poorest, nations and areas in the world, doctors selflessly serving than the United States and the United Nations combined. Cuba sent more doctors to fight the Ebola epidemic in West Africa than any other country in the world combined, hundreds and hundreds of doctors that went to the front lines and fought that and eventually helped conquer it. And some of that finally crept into the world media, the U.S. media. The world knew about it. As that was drawn back, beaten back. So like the question of what Cuba has done, the example, the votes every year in the United Nations, which might make a paragraph in the New York Times, page 6, a little thing on the bottom. Like just a few weeks ago, I was at the UN and witnessed the vote was 191-2 with no abstentions, only the U.S. and Israel voting against, Cuban resolution to end the remaining U.S. sanctions. So President Obama, understood at a certain point that U.S. policy of Cuba, the attempt to openly, belligerently strangle the country and try to overturn the Cuban Revolution was just not sustainable, and that the political cost of that was something that could not be sustained and was becoming too high. It was isolating the United States, especially in Latin America, where all the countries of Latin America, even conservative governments, because of the authority of the Cuban Revolution, its prestige and its resonance among workers and peasants in Latin America, had told the United States there will be no more summits of Latin America unless Cuba is invited. The humiliating for the U.S. votes at the United Nations year after year. So Obama, led a retreat where the Cuban Five were freed, and the Cubans were happy to free this lackey, Alan Gross, the State Department agent that had been sent down there on one of their numerous regime change operations, and established diplomatic relations. But that's not the same as normalizations of relations. They retreated on this question, and sometimes, you know, if we can speak in military terms, sometimes your enemy retreats and in order just to buy some time to recover their position and to prepare for a counteroffensive. On the other hand, sometimes a retreat can turn into a rout. And actually, I think the Cuba Solidarity Movement is trying to take advantage of the openings created by this retreat by the United States government and to finish and end completely once and for all the remaining travel and economic sanctions against Cuba. Cuba also, in a broader sense, represents what is possible when the working people, the average working class, the youth, the farmers, the oppressed, formerly oppressed and exploited, when they can take power and begin to transform their society and themselves to function in the interests of the vast majority. This is the example of Cuba. When we bring in our work Cubans to the United States, and when we organize events for Cuba, we reach out and we find some of the greatest resonance is in the black community, not only because of the understanding of what Cuba has done to fight racism in Cuba and the role in African liberation, but also because of Cuba's solidarity with the struggles that are breaking out in the United States, Black Lives Matter, the fights against cop killings, and so on. And we've made those links in the Solidarity Movement. So for me, I've been an activist, as you said, my whole life, but I am getting a little older, and I'm trying to focus. The reason I focus on Cuba is because it really is an example to bring all these issues as we see a renewal of struggles in the United States, the fight for the $15 an hour minimum wage, the growing labor battles of young people fighting for a decent wage, the tremendous inspirational struggle of a new generation of black and Latino and even many Caucasian youth to fight against the outrageous inequality of the criminal justice system and so on. Cuba is an example that we can point to. Last time I was at Cuba, probably some of the other panelists have been there too, you know, you just notice right away that, you know, that you don't see the cops on the street heavily armed like in Star Wars and so on, and that people feel safe, and what police do exist are actually there to help people. But that's because in Cuba they had a real revolution where the working class was able to take power and to organize society in a different way. And that's an example for everybody.
You know, I was going to ask you for the listening audience, and particularly for many citizens in this country who know very little about Cuba, if you could speak to this narrative that the U.S. is trying to bring democracy and freedom to the Cuban people. How have you viewed that particular concept being played out in Cuba versus how it's being played out in the United States between the two societies? So concept of freedom and democracy.
Well, you know, democracy, what the United States means by democracy is basically, you know, the rule of capital and then within that framework for profit and the rule of a tiny minority. Within that framework, you may have more or less, you know, forms of formal democracy, elections, or freedoms that the American people have won through struggle. The Cuban Revolution, or as Malcolm X said, you know, in America, democracy is nothing but disguised hypocrisy. So they talk all these flowery words, you know, democracy, freedom, human rights. But in practice, if you look, let's just look at the history of Latin America. Every bloody military dictatorship, you know, from Nicaragua under the Somozas to the generals in Argentina to the Papa Doc and Baby Doc and, you know, Cousin Doc and whoever in Haiti, you know, were all, including and Batista himself in Cuba, were all put in power or supported in power by the United States government under Democrats and Republicans. So, you know, to the if democracy or even the formal democratic freedoms that people have conquered in the United States, if they begin to threaten the power structure, I just saw this movie recently on the Black Panther Party that, you know, many people have different views on it. But one thing the movie did show was, you know, when the Black Panther Party was growing and attracting thousands and thousands of black youth and women and young people and all these things, the United States government had no qualms whatsoever under the J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI, and local police agencies of violating every democratic and constitutional right that's on the books to smash through force and violence and subversion, you know, this thing to prevent what they called another black messiah like Malcolm X from developing. Now, in Cuba, you have a, you know, like I said, the overwhelming majority of Cubans conquered democracy, which the Greek root of that word means participation. There is no country in the world that comes close to Cuba in terms of the real direct participation of masses of people in the decisions that affect their lives. And anybody that goes to Cuba can see that. At the same time, you know, there is no question of the fact that, you know, the Cuban Revolution has had to repress its enemies. The United States government, you know, and after the Cuban, you know, over 3,500 Cuban citizens have been killed in terrorist attacks launched out of Miami and other parts of the United States against U.S. law, you know, killed in terrorist bombings and so on and so forth. And the Cubans have had to deal with it. They did not turn the other cheek, you know. They were not going to stand aside and let the revolution be overturned. And, you know, it's true. In Cuba, you know, it's like Fidel said, you strangle us for decades and then you criticize the way we breathe. Well, the Cubans, you know, definitely have dealt with the counter-revolutionary elements that were agents of the United States. It, no more than Lincoln allowed, you know, slave owners' publications during the Civil War when it became a revolutionary war to smash the slaveocracy. You weren't, you know, if you were a pro-slave owner, pro-Confederate, you couldn't print, you know, your paper in the North in 1864 and so on and so forth. So they have defended themselves, and the United States, of course, which creates those conditions, and looks like Chuck was talking about Venezuela too, they, you know, they will say, oh, there's no democracy in Cuba. But the average Cuban worker, they have mass organizations, trade unions. How is it possible to conceive that the United, that Cuba could survive this unremitting assault from U.S. imperialism for all these decades if they did not have the support of the vast majority of people who were not organized, armed, and they have their own mass organizations of women, youth, and so on. Now, we hope, you know, that if we can continue to force back but the Cubans have paid a price for all of this, not only in terms of, you know, a polarization politically, you know, where they had to be vigilant, but also in economic terms, billions of dollars of cost to the Cuban economy. And, you know, it is we hope that if we can continue to push back the remaining U.S. sanctions, if we can force the United States government to stop these subversion plans of regime change, that will put the Cubans in a better position where they can make whatever political and economic changes that are necessary to deepen popular democracy in Cuba, to deepen socialism in Cuba, to deal with bureaucratism and other problems, which they never try to hide and cover up. So as a long answer, I hope that I answered your question.
Well, that's right. That's right. What we're going to do right now, in this audience, we're going to open up our lines to our viewers. You can call in at 323-679-0841, or you can write the comments to our chat line. Right now, we always have our political analysts available. We can bring them in right now, where they may have some issues or some comments that they would like to address to our guest today. We have with us Brother Chuck for Alliance for Global Justice, and Brother Ike for Coalition July 26. And they're talking about right now the issue of looking at Venezuela and Cuba, its relationship to the world, particularly its dynamic between the U.S. And we'd like to bring in our political panelists and you to call in and share your views, your experiences, and your understanding of these various issues. This is one of the things we want to talk about is the whole question of what's going on in your world. So right now we start with Brother Hakeem. We give you the mic in terms of any comments or questions like the raise with our guest, Brother Hakeem. The mic is yours.
Yeah, Brother Alfred, I've got a quick question for both of your guests. One of the things is that, you know, there's an unknown amount of ignorance that permeates the American society. One of the things, when we look at the tremendous amount of unemployment, the spread between the have and the have-nots, the lack of affordable housing, quality education, all these issues that exist in America, somehow people seem to be oblivious in terms of its roots, in terms of why these problems exist in the first place. I would like your guests to talk a little bit about in terms of U.S. foreign policy in terms of investments or propping up groups at various NGOs, various corrupt individuals within states for the sole means in terms of destabilizing their countries. So when we talk about these kind of practices, we talk about billions and billions of dollars that literally they're using in terms of the sole purpose of destabilizing and undermining countries around the world. But it has a curious impact in terms of the inability of the government here in America to provide for American citizens what they need. So can you just talk a little bit about in terms of the repercussions of U.S. foreign policy as related to their own lives and why such poverty exists in America?
Go ahead, Chuck. You take it first, and then Ike.
Okay. To fully answer that would probably take a 13-week college course, or if not an entire degree program. Just to take a couple narrow pieces of that, and maybe Ike will be able to widen it out farther. The U.S. spends something like 60% of our tax money on the military. Part of that budget is the money that it's spending on regime change in countries like Venezuela and Cuba. Millions and millions, hundreds by now of millions of dollars spent in Venezuela to undermine the Bolivarian Revolution through the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and the National Endowment for Democracy, which is NED. And they create false civil society groups that pretend to represent the interests of women or youth or other sectors. They undermine authentic labor movements with money, getting them to focus on just organizing on labor issues rather than having a broader political consciousness and pursuing labor's rightful role as representative of workers in politics and the direction of the country. So, each of these dollars that are spent in, either for bombs or for regime change, or dollars that aren't spent in the United States for education, for health care, for infrastructure, bridges, buses, trains, etc. So we in this country, and particularly people who have the smallest pieces of the economic pie, are directly affected by U.S. foreign policy. The media tries to distract us from that. We know Americans know less about the rest of the world than most of the rest of the world knows about each other, because we're purposely kept ignorant. Yeah, and we should be clear. You use the word ignorant. Ignorant doesn't mean stupid. Ignorant means that you don't have access to the knowledge and information that you need to be informed. So, and it's hard, you know. How do we expect somebody who doesn't even know what they don't know to go out and find the answers? But it's important that we do, because U.S. foreign policy directly affects each and every one of us here at home.
I'd like to take up the question, which is something that I think dominates the thinking of every activist, everybody that's fighting for a better world, for a more just world, which Hakeem raised, which is this question of consciousness. I think, of course, on one level, it shouldn't surprise any of us that are activists to know that when we talk about the uneven consciousness, the ignorance, the lack, the obliviousness that appears on the surface. After all, the media, the government, most organized religions, most of the institutions of capitalist America are dominated and controlled, with all their contradictions and everything else, by the so-called 1%. The media, giant media conglomerates, the stuff that's fed to people. So none of that is surprising. Actually, if you think about it, what's surprising is what might be actually thought of as more surprising is how much, despite all of that, we are able to break through that vanguard layers, can break through all of this fog, or as Ho Chi Minh said when he was commenting on one of President Johnson's bombing, when they were bombing relentlessly North Vietnam, then they'd stop and say, "Now we want a peace, we'll stop." He would say, "They throw dust in your eyes." And that's what happens a lot. They're always throwing dust in our eyes to try to confuse us. But the only thing that can change that, given that, we just can't just lament over that. That is what it is. But what changes that is struggle. It's only when people that are oppressed engage in struggle, in mass struggle, and make contacts, break out of their atomization and their isolation, and see the links with other people, that we can also see tremendous transformations almost overnight in people's consciousness and their awareness. It's like, the old, Malcolm X, when he would talk about, the house Negro and the field Negro and all, he would talk about how, all of the slave owner would always think that the slaves were loyal, and on the surface they appeared maybe docile, but then as soon as they saw that opening, they would rebel. And really, if you look today, I'm very optimistic, actually, because I think we're starting to see a turn in some of these things with these social movements that are breaking out. Where did the struggle for the $15 an hour for minimum wage of restaurant workers and other, lower wage workers, Walmart workers, it sort of just came out of nowhere almost, and all of a sudden now it's a mass movement led by young people and by young people of color in the leadership in many, many areas. The struggle against these cop killings and murderers and case after case has become a movement. Now, when people engage in struggle like this, then their consciousness starts to change. And we see that through history, which is why we have to study history and draw these lessons so we don't become pessimistic and demoralized. We look at, if anybody had told somebody, you know, in 1948 or something like that, that within less than 10 years, that the situation in the Jim Crow South, you know, that there would have been the rise of this massive movement, you know, and that the Jim Crow laws would be smashed, legal segregation would be overturned, and all these changes, you know, take place in a short period of time, because when people engaged in that struggle, their consciousness began to change, and what appeared to be subservient, servile, and docile turned out not to be the case at all. There's many other examples of that, the change in women's consciousness, you know, in terms of what their accepted role was. So the key thing for organizers, you know, and Fidel talks a lot about this in terms of the Cuban Revolution, it transforms people. And once they start, and they start to read different things, they get access to different ideas. They begin to see that they're not so alone. And that's our job as organizers, is to not fight amongst ourselves, but to unify around issues, to move the struggles forward. And believe me, the consciousness always lags behind the objective reality. But when people, you know, of oppression and exploitation, but when we can break through that, you know, and we can unify struggles and organize struggles, consciousness will catch up and make leaps that none of us could think was possible. I'm not trying to be flowery or anything. I'm not trying to underestimate the tremendous challenges and the resources that our enemies have. But when we look to history, and Cuba's a good example, how did this country, like I said earlier, 11.2 million people transform themselves so that they could resist against the mightiest military and economic power in the history of the world, because they gained a new consciousness, they became new people, and they knew how to fight politically and with arms if necessary, but primarily politically to answer and counter every attack against them, every propaganda assault, to appeal to people's better instincts, to win solidarity, to win support. And that's why they've been able to force the Colossus of the North to retreat somewhat and to get the Cuban Five back home and to begin the process of normalized relations.
Okay, what I'm going to do, Brother Aki, that you make a response, quick response, and then we'll go to Brother Anthony and then Jabari. Response, Brother Aki, any?
The only thing is that the brother is absolutely correct in terms of the tremendous amount of disinformation that people are impacting on a daily basis. So clearly, when we talk about terms of organizing, clearly we have our challenges before us. But one of the things I think we also have to take into consideration is the whole issue of class. And in fact, how we mitigate the terms of the impact of class. I think that's one of the very big dimensions in terms of trying to bring forth real movement, you know, in this country, this question of class. And because class is so personal and so intimate, to actually get people to engage in terms of those kind of ideologies, those kind of perceptions, those kind of values that mitigate against revolution is the challenges of our time. But I do appreciate the brother's response, and then I'll close with that.
Okay, Brother Anthony, the mic is yours.
Hey, thanks, Brother Africa. Greetings to our guest tonight. I have a comment regarding the situation in Venezuela, and then a question I'd like both of you to address. First, the comment on the situation in Venezuela in terms of its heavy dependence on petroleum reminds me of Ghana's heavy dependence on cacao during the 60s. It was heavily dependent, and what the imperialists did in order to cause instability was to manipulate the price of cocoa in such a way that Ghana could not get a fair price for the raw material it was producing. And unfortunately, it did not have sufficient time to diversify its economy in such a way that it could avoid this manipulation, so that the prices were so low, some of the people in Ghana blamed the government for their shortages and their ability to get the necessities to sustain life. And it seems like this is somewhat similar in Venezuela. And, one concern is that the imperialists may use this to try to manipulate the results of these elections that are taking place now. My question to both of you concerns the U.S. imperialism's efforts to isolate Venezuela from the rest of Latin America, why it is proceeding to try to reestablish diplomatic relations with Cuba. It is openly trying to isolate Venezuela diplomatically from the rest of Central and South America. And, seemingly an attempt to break up the unity that has been building since the Venezuela Revolution took place in the late 1990s. And I was curious, is based upon your work with some of the countries in ALBA, whether or not the people in these countries see through that or not. And if so, whether they're doing to try to counter that.
Mm-hmm. All right, go with Chuck, and then we go with Ike.
Yeah. Thank you, Brother Anthony, for that example of Ghana. It's a very good example of how, when the empire finds a successful way to do something, they just repeat it and repeat it. I mean, anybody who thinks that we've gone from $4 a gallon gas to $2 a gallon gas because of the invisible hand of the free market needs to stop smoking whatever it is they're smoking. It's exactly that kind of manipulation. I mean, look what it's doing. They're hitting a number of birds with one stone here. Venezuela, Russia, in particular. These tactics don't always work because the U.S. government has been trying to split off Venezuela from the rest of Latin America since Chavez began to be successful with promoting Bolivar's dream of an integrated Latin America. And the rest of Latin America, even the closest U.S. allies, such as Mexico and Colombia, Peru, are not going along with what the U.S. wants to isolate Venezuela. And, of course, the U.S. tried for 50 years to isolate Cuba from the rest of Latin America, and that was a failed policy.
I think we have to look at the bigger picture. I mean, what Chuck says is true and a question, but it's also a question. It's not, I mean, they every day they try to organize millions of little conspiracies, and the CIA's got all these programs, and all that's true, but that's just a given. The fact is objectively that we are in a sort of a slow burning, almost permanent and with no end in sight, world capitalist economic crisis. It's marked by deflation, falling commodity prices, artificial financial manipulations, currency wars, increasing competition between the top capitalist powers and drives to, and this is the context that every so-called third world country and all the biggest capitalist countries, it's a It's a worldwide crisis in which they're pushing to cheapen the value of labor, to roll back all the gains. And this is the context. This is why it is so important politically. Like, for example, Venezuela, the Alba countries, all the tremendous gains of the Bolivarian Revolution in literacy and social gains and medical care and all of that. But with all of that, the Venezuelan economy is still basically a capitalist economy. It is still a part of, and the Venezuelan capitalist class is there. They're still very wealthy, you know. They still have a million points of support from the United States. They still dominate the economy from industry to distribution, and they have a million ways to try to manipulate things and to try to create a sense of crisis, which Chuck so well described previously. The key is, you know, to have a government and to move forward to where the working people, the workers and peasants, the working class takes political power and begins to make a real socialist transformation. So if you look at Cuba during what they called the special period after the Soviet Union collapsed and their economy like contracted, you know, almost like 40%. I mean, it was an incredible crisis. Surgeries, there was so much electricity blackouts that surgeries had to be carried out in the outside under the sun because they wouldn't have electricity. I could give a million examples, you know, oxen, you know, and so on. But the pressures, the reason that Cuba didn't collapse, and they all expected it to collapse, you know, they were breaking out the champagne and stuff in Miami and in the State Department, but was because the Cuban working class had taken power. You know, they had their power in their hands. So they were able to, even despite all the problems and the devastation, the economic crisis, the gains of the revolution were able to be, you know, because Cuba had taken itself outside of, you know, at least within the island of the laws of the capitalist market. Now, of course, you know, it's a long discussion. I know we're probably running out of time, but, you know, this is the key, and this is because this crisis is not going away. This economic crisis is not going away. And everywhere, they don't want to have any example, whether it's Venezuela, Bolivia, they don't want any examples, even if it's not fully socialist revolution, but any gain that can inspire others, because they know that these things can, once you have an example like Venezuela, when you can fight illiteracy and all those things, that those things tend to spread. The same thing is true in the United States. That's why they're so stepping up attacks against the Black Lives Matter movement. They do not want any examples of people fighting.
Okay. And next we'll go to Kami Anthony, and then we'll go to Brother Jabari. Kami Anthony, remarks, response.
Thanks for your comments. Very informative, and I don't have any additional questions at this time.
Okay. Brother Jabari, the mic is yours.
Thank you. Good evening to everyone. My question is, oftentimes you can tell a lot by what isn't being discussed, and given that there's an upcoming presidential election in the United States, you notice that this issue in regards to relationship with Cuba has not been a key focal point in regards to when candidates present their platform. So my question to our guest tonight is, how do you see whomever that future president is impacting the push for in regards to a furthering relations with Cuba in the future?
Let's go Ike first, and then Ike.
Well, my opinion is that it's going to be very hard, no matter who wins the presidential election, to get this genie back in the bottle, you know, in terms of U.S.-Cuba relations. A lot of the some of the Republican candidates like Marco Rubio or you know, are talking about how they're going to reverse all of this and so on. And, you know, I'm dubious about that. Of course, we have to be vigilant. But I think that the ruling class as a whole understands, as I mentioned previously, that the policy was just not sustainable. You know, they now on the U.S. elections in general, I mean, they're going to try to, like I said earlier, to try, they retreat to try to regroup so that they can do a counteroffensive. But I think that that has to be, from their point of view, within the framework of having at least diplomatic relations with Cuba to revert back to the policy of, you know, open, overt regime change and so on. You know, I don't think that's going to happen. I think the pressure is in the opposite direction to, like, force them to end the economic travel sanctions, the pressure from the United States and from the world. But at the same time, the election in general, it's reflecting in the distorted way that these elections in the United States always do, because it's a very distorted prism to reflect what people actually think. But you can see in, like, the Sanders campaign and the Trump campaign for the Democrats, Republicans, it's a reflection of the real volatility, the anger, the frustration, you know, that exists in the so-called electorate. And I suspect on a lot of these questions, like a lot of the Republicans, they criticize, you know, hey, Obama's weak and he's letting Putin walk all over him in Syria. But a lot of it is just BS. You know, I don't think they would do anything different. I think Obama is managing the decline of the social weight of U.S. imperialism in the world, the relative decline. And I don't think the Republicans would really be in a position, you know, to the idea of them sending, you know, hundreds of thousands or even tens of thousands of troops to Syria and things like that. It's just not real. So I think that in terms of Cuba, I think that Cuba is moving forward. I think as more Americans are able to go to Cuba and they see the gap between the propaganda, what the lies that they've been fed, and the reality of Cuba, the vibrancy of its people, the cultural and artistic scene, even people that aren't necessarily that political, I think they're going to say, wow, you know, we have really been, they've really tried to bamboozle us on this. Go ahead, Chuck.
I agree with everything that Ike said. Whoever gets elected, first and foremost, is getting elected to be the president of the empire. And Democrat or Republican, that's going to mean pursuing the same policies. Doesn't matter. One president might be rhetorically more bellicose than another, but I mean, look at Obama. He's not bellicose at all. And how many countries has he bombed? I mean, more than Bush. and including overthrowing an African country, Libya, and turning it into a failed state. So people who put their hopes, unfortunately, too many liberals impute their own hopes onto the candidate of their choice, and that person is going to be constrained by the fact that he's the top political officer of the empire and has to do the empire's business. So to you and me, it just doesn't make much difference which of them get elected.
I would, if I could just do a quick one of my favorite Malcolm X quotes, is when he says the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans is the Republicans stick the knife in your back 6 inches and the Democrats pull it out 1.
Okay. On that note, what we would like to do, Brother Jabari, any final comments to that response?
I just add one more final comment. First and foremost, thank you for your response. And one of the reasons I decided to choose that particular question is when you look at U.S. relations with the Caribbean, you notice that there's a historical precedent in regards to why the Louisiana Purchase occurred. And that was because of the growing momentum once Haiti was liberated. They were very concerned then. It just makes you think in this day and time when things are more dire, where people are waking up to the reality, that those kind of things and decisions could be made again. So I just used the Louisiana Purchase as a historical precedent for my comments. Once again, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay, on that note, we'd like to let our audience know that you have been listening to Chuck Leal and Brother Chuck Kaufman at Ike Mayhem, representative of the Alliance for Global Justice and July 26th Coalition. They've been speaking to the team, telling the truth, what's going on in your world. We would like each one of them to take a final 2-minute summarization on their final comments, and how can the people join and find out more about your organization? I'll start with you first, Chuck.
Okay. I guess I would say keep listening to Lee's show here and alternative information, the Alliance for Global Justice's webpage is www.afgj.org. That's the initials of Alliance for Global Justice. There's lots of information on there, and when we do delegations, I mean, one of the most important things that people can do to end the ignorance is to go to these countries and see for themselves what the situation is. So we post that. We also have an alerts list that you can sign up for on the webpage and get periodic information and action items. And I just want to say thank you for inviting me on the show.
Thank you, Lee, and all the brothers on the panel. I would like to just give out the website of our organization, the July 26 Coalition of New York and New Jersey. It's July26coalition.org. And we have a very nice website page with lots of interaction and stuff. People can look it up. I've known Brother Lee for many years. We've worked together on different projects. We're planning on doing some activities in the future, the opening to bring more Cubans to the United States and to, have events. So I'm sure we're going to be working together. And just I just urge everybody, when we fight against, as we become part of these growing movements, let's just leave all of our baggage behind, as they say on the railroad, and just unite and fight together. And I think we're gonna be entering a period of renewed struggle and victories. And I want to thank you again for having us on, and we look forward to working together in the future.
And we'd like to thank both of you for your contribution to this program and your continued work toward trying to advance all of humanity. We'd like to thank you. And moving along, we're going to like to let our audience know that for the next 15 minutes, we're going to ask our panelists to give their perspective and their position on that theme tonight. And the theme is telling the truth, what is going on in your world. We'd like to hear from our panelists. Where are they at in terms of what's going on in that world? Some issues or ideas or concepts that is important to our people. We can do this for the next 15 minutes. And for this particular program, we're going to be ending a little earlier. Normally, we would have expanded to additional 30 minutes, but there's this special circumstance that came up, which has caused us to have to end this program a little bit earlier. But we remind you that you can always listen to Africa on the Move every Sunday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And if you have any views or comments, we welcome you to write us at AfricaOnTheMove2@gmail.com. As you know, that this particular program is a community-based program under the direction of the African Awareness Association. You can always contact us directly by writing us at African Unaligned Awareness Unaligned Association as related to this particular program. So again, we'd like to thank everybody for their support. And Brother Hackey, again, can you remind us about the free ride trip to Cuba that the African Awareness Association is taking before we go to our closing remark on that theme? Brother Hackey.
Sure. In December, we'll be taking another freedom ride in defense of the Cuban Revolution and support of the Cuban people. Now, this project or this trip is going to take 14 days in duration. And while we're there, we'll be in Matanzas and Havana. Now, in Havana, we're going to have the opportunity to participate with the International Jazz Festival in addition to celebrate independence for Cuba. In addition to that, bringing in the new year. So we encourage you, to come on out, go to Cuba, opportunity to sit down and discuss with people in Cuba any political concerns they may have. I think it'd be a growing experience. It'd be something that certainly would counter a lot of the disinformation and propaganda that permeates in American society. So the only way to bring clarity is actually engage in discourse, to actually talk to people about what the issues are, and then themselves will create be indispensable in terms of creating a tremendous amount of growth. Now, for more information, you can contact us at African_awareness_association@yahoo.com or call 804-549-7492 or area code 202-714-94335. Thank you.
And we'd like to support us in this audience to take this special opportunity to go to Cuba and see for yourself. Go and reserve your tickets by contacting the African Awareness Association. Trust me, once you go, you'll never forget it. Cuba has done so much for African people, humanity, at the best we could do, at least say hello to our brothers and sisters. So let's now deal with this issue of this theme tonight for our panelists. We're going to start with our youth panelists. Brother Zabari, what's going on in your world? What would you like to share with our audience tonight?
What's going on?
Stay with Brother Zabari. I thank you, man. It's awesome. We're going to come back to him. Let's go with Brother Anthony. Brother Anthony, in terms of the theme tonight, what would you like to share in terms of this issue of what's going on in your world?
Certainly. I think as one of your guests, Nahum, had pointed out, is that the crisis in capitalism is intensifying, and we see that in the U.S. in terms of the fact that the police are becoming increasingly more repressive, and also the fact that that the settler colonialists are becoming more openly racist. There was an article I read over the internet yesterday about a group of students at the University of Missouri protesting against the university administration, indicating that they weren't that the administration wasn't doing enough to address the racism that's taking place on that campus. This was at the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri. And even though it was this particular campus, I'm pretty sure that it is not isolated by any stretch. And due to the advent of social media primarily, there are more and more stories coming out again about police repression against our people. So those are some things I want to share tonight.
Brother Aki?
Brother Aki, can I come back in?
Can you hear us, Brother Aki?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought Jabari was speaking.
Now, we'll come back to Jabari. Brother Aki, your mic is yours.
Okay, sure. One of the things that perturbed me to no end is the recent finding in terms of the adjudication of this cop that killed Tamir Rice, the young brother out of the Midwest who was killed by the police, allegedly pointing a toy gun at the cops. One of the things is that, you know, when we talk about the killing, wholesale killing of African people generally, nothing is more atrocious than the killing of young kids. Now, this notion that somehow that children don't play with toy guns, or that a toy gun in and of itself is sufficient enough reason to blow someone away, it really angers me to no end. The thing is that people raise the question, well, how would the cops know it's a toy gun? Now, one of the things is that when you're dealing with a child, I mean, the implication is that children play with toy guns, stores sell toy guns. And so all it took was a little bit of vigilance, you know, a little bit of taking cover and barking orders to the kid to resolve the situation, as opposed to the cop immediately going to the fire and just throw away a 12-year-old. And then for the course of, for the power structure there, to find that it was justifiable in terms of blowing away the 12-year-old kid. So it seems to me the implication in terms of the value or lack of value of African life is very, very clear. So it seems to me at some point we have to get the gist of what's going on here in terms of just how much the system is diametrically opposed to African people's survival. And nothing more clear than this whole recent article about Loretta Lynch, who's currently the Attorney General for the United States. You know, as you know, Brother Africa, recently, you know, it's been a great call in terms, you know, keeping statistical profile in terms of police killings in this country, because the killing of African men and African women has grown, you know, disproportionately. And so, therefore, that's a concern in terms of if we keep track of the numbers, then we'll do a better job in terms of staying on top of, you know, police killings and ultimately creating some type of avenue by which to resolve or to put an end to police killings. Well, this current Attorney General, an African American woman, position is that under no circumstances will she hold police agencies accountable in terms of compiling statistics, in terms of, you know, police murders. Now, she says that because she says she's more concerned in terms of, you know, the police and the community relationships than she is in terms of keeping statistical breakdowns in terms of how many citizens are killed, you know, on a daily basis. It seems to me if this isn't clear in terms of the apathy or the lack of compassion toward African lives, if people don't get this, then I guess they never will. They simply can't grasp the magnitude of the kind of systemic injustice that's going on in society when it comes to killing of African people in society. And as Brother Anthony alluded to, one of the things that when you talk about deterioration of the capitalist economy, we have to be very, very clear that irrespective of title, status, or job, that the bottom line is that we are, in fact, all perceived as enemies, except that the only difference come to African people, given the disproportionate amount of injustice that we're confronted with on a daily basis, given our marginalization in society, we become more than just enemies of the state. We become super enemies of the state. And so, therefore, it doesn't matter what kind of job you hold or how much money you make, that in fact all the cops see is the color of your skin, so therefore in his mind does justify your liquidation. So it seems to me that at some point the people have to begin to grasp the magnitude of the situation in society and just how dangerous, how perilous it is for African people. But having said that, understanding that, but it's just that African people who are in peril, but it's people across the board. Recently we had situations where one white individual was shot for no reason at all. Other one was shot in the back with his hands up in the air for no reason at all. So it's peculiar to people who are poor, people impoverished, or people who are, quote-unquote, dispossessed. So we have this phenomenon. And so at some point it seems to me that we have to begin to address this crisis that exists in society. And I think the only reasonable response has to be an organized response in terms of putting an end to mass police killings. Thanks.
Okay, do we have Brother Jabari? Are you back?
Yes, I'm here.
Final remarks on the theme. What would you like to share with our listeners?
In regards to what I have noticed, this is something that impacts all of us both locally and globally, is I recently saw the article that was talking about some of the new technology that the military will be using. It was very scary when I was witnessing what I was looking at, because it was very reminiscent of some of those same type of articles of destruction that you see in movies like The Terminator and other science fiction movies, where 30, 40 years ago, we just looking at this and, you know, people marvel at the special effects. But now, the same thing you saw in the movie is going to be used against you in regards to how they address conflicts, because it's going to raise questions such as, if you create a number of vehicles that have to be unmanned, what's going to happen with the extra manpower that you don't need? Is that going to be sent home to be conducting certain operations, or are there other deviant activities that are going to take place in terms of how you're going to use people, because you're finding less and less ways to use manpower and resulting more on robotics or other forms of technology?
Okay, we'd like to thank you, Brother Jabari, for your remarks, and we'd like to thank our guests, Ike and Brother Chuck, and always our panelists and this audience for tuning in this evening to Africa on the Move. Remember, Africa on the Move, here to speak in truth to power and to give information to our people so they can think, but more importantly, to expose them and introduce them to organizations so they can think more clearly, and to organizations so they can be effective in bringing about the kind of change that our people desire. We know that there is no progress, so encourage all of the people who want to change their situation is to engage and struggle, because that's the only way changes will come. Until next time, you can support African Awareness Association by going on their funeral ride. If you can't go, you'd like to make a contribution to help support them out, you can send that contribution to the African Awareness Association, P.O. Box 4433, Richmond, Virginia 23220. We also, Brother Anthony, would like for you to also introduce again and state information in terms of how they can support the AAPRPGC, and how you can find out more information in terms of joining and supporting the organization.
Certainly. To learn more about the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC, you can visit our website at www.a-aprp-gc.org. And if you would like more information, you can contact us at info@aprpgc.org.
Okay, brothers and sisters, we are running a course. We thank all for their participation and contribution here, as we said earlier. We look forward to seeing you next Sunday, same time, same place, from 7 to 9 p.m. And let's continue to strive to go forward at our backwards level. As the voice for Africa removed, Brother Africa, we'll see you next week. We thank you. Forever.
Africa. Africa. Center of the world. Latitude zero. Longitude zero. Planned by the Creator. The Xanthropus was the first man found on the earth. That earth was the motherland, Africa. We know that without total understanding of what happened in the past, it would be difficult to relate to the future. We know that within the structure of the music, there should be a message, and the message should be truth. So now, we give you Africa, the center of the world.